You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Denk an den 31. Juli.
Wieso?
Last Call für deine Steuer.
Oh no, ich weiß gar nicht, wo ich anfangen soll.
Weil wieso Steuer? Das ist wie Steuererklärung, nur ohne Stress.
Ist das einfach?
Klar, macht fast alles automatisch.
Dauert das lange?
Nö, einfach per App.
Na dann.
Hol dir jetzt dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer. Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 115, War to the Knife. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon subscribers. It really does mean a lot to me that so many of you believe enough in this project to put a little bit of your money behind it. I would also like to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. I just released the 24th of our special patrons-only bonus episodes, which included topics like Corsica under the Empire, the French royal court in exile, and the Baker Rifle, made famous by Bernard Cornwell's Sharp series. If any of that sounds interesting to you, you can listen to it, as well as 2 years' worth of similarly fascinating bonus material, for just $2 a month. And of course, Patreon is the only place to get ad-free versions of the regular episodes. I hope you'll consider joining us. Anyway, we left off last time in the autumn of 1808. Napoleon had just concluded a frustrating diplomatic summit with Emperor Alexander of Russia in the German city of Erfurt. Emboldened by French failures in Iberia, the Habsburgs were rattling their sabers once again. Bonaparte had been hoping to secure a firm commitment from the Russians to defend their French allies in case of an Austrian invasion, but had only managed to get a very vague statement of support. He didn't know it yet, but this failure was due in large part to the betrayal of one of his closest advisors. Talleyrand had begun to offer secret assistance to Emperor Alexander. Despite his failure at Erfurt, Napoleon pressed ahead with his plans to move the Grande Armée from its bases in Germany to the Iberian theater so he could finally lead his best troops against the Spanish patriots. However, before we get into that story, we need to get caught up on what was going on in Iberia. Events on the peninsula had not stood still while Napoleon went to Erfurt. We've talked extensively in past episodes about what the Spanish and French were up to in the spring and summer of 1808, but have mostly glossed over the other two big players in this theater of the war, Portugal and Great Britain. As I mentioned last episode, by the time Napoleon began preparing his new offensive into Spain, there were tens of thousands of redcoats on Iberian soil. This was just the beginning of a major commitment. Over the next 5 years, nearly 100,000 British soldiers would be killed or wounded in this theater of the war. We already discussed the first major British intervention in Iberia, the evacuation of the Portuguese court and government to Brazil. British involvement in Spain was a bit trickier. The two countries were at war with one another, which tends to make cooperation difficult. And this was not just some technicality. There had been hard fighting between British and Spanish forces, mostly on the high seas and in far-flung colonies. This was not just the consequence of the Spanish alliance with France. Spain and Britain had been rivals for longer than any living person could remember. For 40 out of the last 100 years, the two countries had been at war. This was not quite as bitter a rivalry as the one between France and Austria. But people in both countries, especially those in the government and the military, saw each other as enemies. But in the uncertain world of early 19th century European geopolitics, today's enemy could be tomorrow's ally. Those in power knew this well. The British had been involved in the Spanish resistance to Napoleon from almost the very beginning. Long before the outbreak of hostilities in Spain, even before the Dos de Mayo uprising in Madrid, there had already been secret communications between senior Spanish and British military officers. The leading Spanish general involved in these talks was none other than Francisco Castaños, who would go on to win the great triumph at Bailén only a few months later. He really was invaluable to his country in this early phase of the war. Once the fighting broke out, the British were able to respond almost immediately. As most of you probably know, there was a small but powerful British stronghold in Iberia, Gibraltar. As luck would have it, there was actually already a small expeditionary force stationed at Gibraltar, just waiting for the invasion order. They had been assembled for a plan to seize the city of Ceuta in North Africa, a Spanish colony. How quickly things can change. At the outbreak of fighting between France and the Spanish patriots, this force was diverted to Cadiz, where they got a rapturous reception from the locals. Only a few months earlier, I doubt anyone would have imagined crowds of Spaniards cheering the redcoats with cries of "Long live the English!" These were only a few thousand men, they didn't have a massive impact on events, and they did have some struggles coordinating with the Spanish. There was the natural wariness you might expect between former enemies, and as we've discussed in past episodes, there was a lot of confusion on the Spanish side in this early phase, due to the improvised nature of the rebel juntas. As always, the British press loved a good story, the more lurid and dramatic the better. Once the fighting broke out in Spain, the heroism of the rebels and the brutality of the French crackdown gave the writers of Fleet Street plenty of material to work with. The British public was bombarded with violent tales of the rebellion in Spain, and understandably, there was a growing sense of indignation. In many ways, Britain was a divided society during this period. Between rival political factions, between city and countryside, and most of all, along class lines. But in mid-1808, sympathy for the Spanish rebels and outrage at French atrocities united almost everyone. On June 8, 1808, a delegation from the Junta of the province of Asturias on the northern coast of Spain arrived in London to great fanfare. This was very early in the rebellion, only 2 days after the First Battle of El Bruc, the first real engagement of the war. At this point, the juntas had no formal legal recognition, and as of yet, there hadn't been any attempt to unite the various juntas into a provisional national government. The representatives from Asturias petitioned the British government for arms and money to help them raise an army to resist the French. The issue was raised in Parliament, and Whigs and Tories alike, from every faction, fell all over themselves to endorse the proposal. Supporting the junta was very obviously in Britain's national interest, and it enjoyed overwhelming public support, an obvious winning issue, even for the most craven and cautious members of the House. Interestingly, the petition from the Asturians specifically stated that they did not want British soldiers on their soil. All this trouble had begun when the Spanish government had allowed supposedly friendly troops with a hidden agenda to enter the country. The Junta of Asturias still did not trust the British, and did not want to repeat this mistake. Clearly, the new allies needed to build trust. Later that summer, a Royal Navy operation in northern Europe, over 1,000 miles from Spain, would help prove Britain's good faith. If you'll think back to episode 109, you might remember that back in 1806, Spain's former prime minister, Manuel Godoy, had attempted to betray Napoleon, and failed miserably. In response to this insult, Bonaparte had extracted painful concessions from Spain. The most important of these was the formation of the Division of the North, a force of about 15,000 of Spain's best soldiers, who were deployed in Denmark to help the French and the Danes guard the coast against another British attack. This really was a help to Napoleon. That force freed up 15,000 French soldiers for duties elsewhere. But they were primarily there for other reasons, as hostages to ensure the good behavior of the Spanish government, and to weaken Spain's military. If the Spanish ever did betray France, they wouldn't be able to use those 15,000 of their best soldiers in the fight against Napoleon. This force was officially called the Division of the North, but is usually referred to as the La Romana Division, after its commander, the Marquis of La Romana. Throughout this period we've been discussing for the past few episodes, La Romana and his men were still along the North Sea coast, watched closely by the French, and unable to play any role in the astounding events playing out in their homeland. British intelligence sent an agent to make secret contact with La Romana and his officers, a Scottish Roman Catholic priest named James Robertson. Robertson's orders were to convince the leaders of the Division of the North to accept evacuation by the Royal Navy, so they could return to Spain and join the fight. Knowing the Spanish aristocracy's fondness for tobacco, Robertson posed as a cigar merchant, and in this guise was able to get an audience with La Romana. It took time for the two men to feel each other out. La Romana couldn't be sure that Robertson wasn't secretly working for the French, and Robertson couldn't be sure that La Romana wasn't a closet Bonapartist. But after a tense back and forth, the two men came to trust one another. Perhaps the cigars helped. The two sides were in agreement, but it would be a tricky operation. The French were already questioning the division's loyalty. Napoleon raised their pay and awarded La Romana the Medal of the Legion of Honor, hoping to buy their allegiance. La Romana's superior, Marshal Jean-Baptiste Bernadotte, tried to make sure his Spanish units were isolated from one another, and never far from the watchful eyes of reliable French regiments. Perhaps unsurprisingly, there was unrest. In late July, the division was ordered to swear allegiance to King Joseph Bonaparte. The men were assembled and prompted to make their oath, but they shouted out King Ferdinand's name instead. None of the Spanish officers objected, and none reported this incident to Bernadotte. On July 21st, one regiment mutinied. The men would have been better served to wait, but La Romana had only informed a few of his most trusted senior officers of his plot with Robertson, the only way to ensure the plan remained secret. A French general was killed in the mutiny, and the division came under even more scrutiny. Finally, on August 7th, the operation began. Spanish troops seized the harbor of Nyborg, and La Romana began concentrating his men in the area, hoping to hold the port for as long as possible and get as many of his men as possible back to Spain. What followed was a confused and nerve-wracking few weeks. As I've mentioned in past episodes, amphibious operations with Napoleonic-era technology were difficult, frustrating business. A pro-French officer in the Spanish ranks betrayed the plan to Marshal Bernadotte almost as soon as it went into motion, and the French scrambled to prevent the evacuation. In the end, nearly 10,000 of the division's original 15,000 men made it home safely. Over a third of them either died in the operation or were stranded in Denmark. But, under the circumstances, it was a very impressive achievement. 10,000 more trained regulars would be a boon to the Patriot cause. As we've discussed in the past few episodes, they were sorely lacking trained soldiers and officers, and these were some of the country's best. But perhaps more important was the moral victory. Napoleon's hostages had been stolen right from under his nose, and France's former allies had deserted them to join the struggle against French domination. It made very good headlines back in Britain, and raised the spirits of the Spanish resistance. As you can see, these early attempts at Anglo-Spanish cooperation were not entirely smooth, but the former enemies were cooperating, and even at this early stage, their efforts were already producing dividends. Cooperation between the British and the Portuguese faced no such obstacles. Although Portugal did not formally join the war until they were forced to by Napoleon's invasion, the British and the Portuguese had enjoyed good relations for centuries. The assistance of the Royal Navy and the Portuguese government's flight to Brazil had gotten their collaboration off on the right foot, and more substantial British intervention in Portugal was already in the works. You may recall that in late 1807, Portugal had been occupied in a joint French-Spanish invasion. The invaders set up a temporary military administration, led by General Jean-Andoche Junot. Junot had been one of Napoleon's aides way back in the very early days of his career, and was among the few we can call a personal friend of the emperor. Or at least, he had been at one point. Junot's hard drinking and outrageous, erratic behavior had worn out Napoleon's patience. He had been sent to Portugal partially as an opportunity to redeem himself, and partially just to get him away from Paris and out of Bonaparte's hair. The emperor had promised his old friend a baton of a marshal of France if he completed his mission successfully. But after the escape of the Portuguese government and treasury, the blue baton remained elusive. As the months wore on, Junot must have felt the title of marshal slipping further and further away. The occupation of Portugal was not going well. Junot had crossed the Pyrenees with roughly 25,000 men. This was more than enough to deal with the small, poorly maintained Portuguese army. They hadn't even offered token resistance. But, faced with the task of occupying a country of 89,000 square kilometers, or 34,000 square miles, with poor infrastructure and a restive population, 25,000 men suddenly didn't seem like quite so much. Junot and his troops were not alone. They had their Spanish allies sharing the burden. However, as the Spanish patriots began to resist Napoleon's occupation, it became increasingly clear that Junot would not be able to rely on the loyalty of these units. As the War of Spanish Independence heated up, Junot was forced to send reinforcements to hard-pressed French garrisons near the Portuguese border. Add to that the losses his troops had sustained on their brutally difficult march into Portugal, and the men who were killed by bandits or partisans, and those who fell ill or died from other reasons, and you get a serious manpower problem. Junot's command hadn't fought a single battle since they left France, but their ranks were looking dangerously thin. With this depleted force, Junot had to fulfill three objectives. First, keep a lid on the local population, who were already beginning to follow the example of their Spanish neighbors, and launching serious campaigns of resistance. Second, he had to maintain close supervision over his Spanish units, many of whom were simply biding their time, waiting for an opportunity to mutiny, desert, or even attack their French comrades. And third, he had to keep a strong mobile reserve force that could be rushed to the coast in case the British attempted a landing. Junot was not Napoleon's best general, but I don't think even the emperor himself could have adequately pursued all three of those goals with less than a single army corps. Napoleon believed Junot's concerns about a British landing were nothing but paranoia, brought on by the bad news from Spain. But Junot was right to be worried. As he struggled to maintain the occupation over Portugal, a British expeditionary force was already being assembled in southern Ireland for just this purpose. This force had originally been intended to cross the Atlantic, to secure Spain's New World colonies. Napoleon had indeed hoped to bring these regions into the empire, but the Spanish colonies had not proved any more receptive to the French than their compatriots back in Europe. It seemed French influence in the New World would remain as weak as ever, even without British intervention, and so the expedition was diverted to Portugal, where they might have a real impact. This was a relatively small force, only about 15,000 strong, but they included some very good units, and would be led by a capable commander, General Sir Arthur Wellesley, the future Duke of Wellington. Later in life, Wellesley would be practically deified by the British public, but at this stage in his career, the 39-year-old general was only really well known within the army. He had an impressive resume of battlefield victories, but they had all been won far from home, in British India. Still, he was already Sir Arthur Wellesley. The British government thought highly enough of him to award him a knighthood. But he had yet to live up to his potential, and was eager to prove himself. However, by now, he had been back from India for 3 years, and still had yet to face a challenge worthy of his ambitions. We last saw him routing a ragtag army of untrained Danish conscripts outside Copenhagen almost exactly a year earlier. Unsurprisingly, he hadn't won any great acclaim for defeating this somewhat pathetic enemy in the course of an invasion that many found morally reprehensible. Opinion was divided on Wellesley within the British Army. Many saw him as a solid officer, but others dismissed him as a so-called sepoy general, fit to command Indian auxiliary troops, called sepoys, in a low-stakes colonial war, but not up to the task of commanding a real army against a real enemy. Apologies to our Indian listeners, but that is how many in Britain thought of their colonial generals. One officer assigned to the expedition wrote, quote, "If Sir Arthur thinks he can beat the French troops as easily as he has been accustomed to conquer the Indians, we will suffer greatly." End quote. Meanwhile, back in Portugal, the situation was spinning out of control. More and more French troops were being killed in partisan attacks. Anti-French pamphlets and posters appeared in major cities. In areas where French control was weak, the Portuguese copied their Spanish neighbors and formed juntas along the same lines as the Spanish juntas. You may remember that the French had tried to disband the Portuguese army. Well, many Portuguese officers and soldiers decided they would rather not be disbanded. They were joined by new units, formed by the juntas from patriotic volunteers. With French control slipping all over the country, these forces grew bolder in their attacks on the occupiers. The task facing Junot and his dwindling command was simply impossible. Finally, on June 26th, Junot called a council of war with all his senior officers. They decided their only option was to concentrate the remaining French forces in Portugal in and around Lisbon, hoping to hunker down in the highly defensible capital until the wider strategic situation improved. Then they could retake the country. Off the coast, Wellesley and his expeditionary force were making their final preparations for the invasion. The general was dismayed to learn that he had already been relieved of command. The British government had decided to double down on this operation. More men were already on their way to Portugal, along with more senior generals, who would supersede Wellesley once they arrived. Wellesley was bitterly disappointed, but he took it well. A lesser general might have tried to rush the operation, to win as many victories as possible before being relieved, risking the army but ensuring his reputation. Wellesley did not do this. The operation finally began on August 1st, about 2 weeks after the Battle of Bailén. The Redcoats landed at a place called Monjego Bay, roughly between Lisbon and Porto, Portugal's second city in the north of the country. In this era, these types of operations were always a risk. There was a lot that could go wrong. But the God of the Seas smiled on the British. For 5 days, the weather was clear and the water was tranquil. Wellesley got his full force ashore with no issues, and was joined by several thousand Portuguese allies. Portuguese peasants brought gifts of food for the British soldiers. Rifleman Benjamin Harris of the 95th Rifles would later recall, quote, "We feasted in our first entrance into Portugal, like a company of aldermen," end quote. It was a very different reception than the French had gotten when they entered the country a few months earlier. By the time Junot learned of the landings, it was far too late to contest them. It seemed the writing was on the wall for the French occupation of Portugal. But who knows? Junot had studied the art of war under Napoleon himself. Maybe he could pull off a miracle. At this point, it might have taken a miracle to salvage his situation. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Portugal, a French column under General Henri Loison was marching east in an attempt to re-establish lines of communication with French forces in Spain. Loison encountered a small, joint Spanish-Portuguese Patriot army near the city of Évora in southeastern Portugal. They were deployed for a battle, hoping to prevent the French from taking the town. The larger, more experienced French force shattered the Patriots almost immediately. The survivors ran for the town, and Loison ordered a pursuit. As French troops entered Évora, they began killing indiscriminately, cutting down retreating Patriot militiamen and civilians alike. Loison did little to restrain his men. Exact numbers are sketchy, but perhaps as many as several hundred civilians were killed before order was finally restored. General Loison already had a reputation for brutality. After the massacre at Évora, he became the most infamous Frenchman in Portugal. The Patriots nicknamed him Maneta, or One Hand, because he was missing an arm from a hunting accident. Every Portuguese patriot dreamed of killing the despised Maneta. Later in the war, there is a story of a French general captured by the Portuguese, keeping both hands raised above his head as he was brought into custody. He wanted to survive, and he knew that meant making sure everyone knew he was not Maneta. Shortly after the French sacked Évora, Loison received a message from Junot, ordering him back to Lisbon to help face the threat from Wellesley's army. The Battle of Évora had been for nothing. After learning of the British landing, Junot sent a small force of about 4,000 men north from Lisbon under General Henri de Laborde, with orders to delay the British as long as possible, so Junot could gather all his troops for a decisive battle. De Laborde was a well-regarded general, perhaps the best of Junot's subordinates. He had gotten his start in the military as a private in the old Royal Army, after dropping out of seminary. He probably would have made a good priest, tall, with a loud, booming voice and a severe face. Apparently, even in middle age, he remembered enough Latin from his seminary days to carry on a conversation. In mid-August, de Laborde found a strong defensive position in an area of high ground near the town of Rolissa. On August 17th, he drew up his lines and dared Wellesley to attack. The French were outnumbered nearly 4-1 and had no desire for a hard, drawn-out fight. They had been sent to delay the enemy, not to fight a major engagement. But by making a stand, they would force Wellesley to stop his march and deploy his full force. De Laborde hoped he could manage a fighting retreat, slow the British march by several days without losing too many of his own men. On the other side, Wellesley would try to use his superior numbers to outflank De Laborde and destroy his force, pin them down with a frontal assault, then bring another column around the flank. A tried-and-true strategy. We've seen many generals employ it over the course of this show. In fact, it was one of Napoleon's favorites. The battle would see the British trying to overwhelm their enemy, and the French trying to make their enemy pay for every step forward, without allowing themselves to be pinned down. A sizable Portuguese contingent fought alongside the British. They were very inexperienced and lacked training and equipment, but they were eager to avenge the crimes of the occupation. A British officer described the impetuousness of the Portuguese, who were volunteers from a nearby university. Quote, "They were called light troops, but were chiefly formed from the students of Coimbra, whom the fire of patriotism had started from their academical benches. They were armed with fowling pieces, hunting rifles, carbines, and other such deadly engines. The center had halted to give time for the operations on the flanks, but our Portuguese friends seemed anxious for the fray. They pressed on in front without any orders, and the moment they got in sight of the French on the lower plateau, began blazing away with great vigor." End quote. The French offered resistance, but once they fell under sustained pressure, executed a fighting retreat to a secondary position on good high ground. However, the British were hot on their heels. By the time the new defensive line was established, there were already British riflemen on the heights, harassing them. At this point in the battle, an officer of the 95th Rifles had a remarkable close call. Quote, "About this time, I had a most providential escape. I was almost faint with anxiety to get the men properly placed, and with the immense heat and fatigue. In short, I was like most of the others, completely exhausted, and would have given a guinea for a mouthful of water, when one of our officers asked me if I would take a mouthful of wine. He held his canteen to my mouth, and it was not there a second when a shot went through his hand and the canteen which was in my mouth, and covered my face with wine. The poor fellow dropped immediately. I left a soldier with him and proceeded with my company, pitying the officer who was wounded, but fully convinced that the ball was better through his hand than my head, which has proved to be the case, as he is quite recovered. End quote. For any of you who are unaware, a guinea was a type of coin used in Britain at this time. Roughly speaking, it was worth just shy of $100 in today's money, so he really was thirsty. The most difficult mission of the day fell on the British 29th Regiment of Foot. They were ordered to assault an entrenched enemy position, which could only be approached through a small ravine that was, according to one witness, so narrow that only three men could stand abreast. The regiment's colonel was killed, but they pressed forward, engaging the French with fixed bayonets. The fighting was extremely intense. French troops from the 70th Regiment of the Line managed to grab the flag of the 29th, but they in turn were cut down, and the flag was retaken. Finally, after a horrible melee, the French fell back, and the position was secured. Half the British casualties suffered that day were among the 29th. Wellesley would later call them the best regiment in the army. Unfortunately for the British, the terrain in this area was very favorable for the defenders. General de la Borde had chosen his ground well. Every time the French were forced out of their positions, they simply fell back to the next hill and formed up again. Still, the constant pressure from superior numbers was taking a toll on Delaborde's troops. The 70th Regiment of the Line fell back in disorder. It looked like they were about to rout. But then, a figure on horseback galloped in front of the whole regiment, blocking their path and ordering them to rally. It was the regimental drum major, who had somehow found a horse and taken it upon himself to do what the regiment's officers could not. He brandished his ceremonial mace at the men, and demanded they hold firm, unless they wanted a beating. Amazingly, the regiment complied. Still, despite the best efforts of its drum majors, de la Borde's force was in bad shape. It was the afternoon of a particularly hot Portuguese summer day, and they had spent nearly all of it engaged in hard fighting against a force more than three times their size. General de la Borde himself had been shot in the neck, but the former seminarian must have had a guardian angel, because the wound was not serious. Sometime after 4 PM, the French made their final retreat, and the British did not pursue. Wellesley did not have much cavalry at his disposal. Horses are not good travelers at sea, so these types of expeditionary forces only ever included a bare minimum of mounted troops. And besides, Wellesley had gotten word of British reinforcements landing up the coast to the north. He didn't want to stray too far from their landing beach in case they ran into trouble. And so General de la Borde and his battered, exhausted command were able to fall back to Lisbon without too much trouble. The Battle of Rolissa has gone down in history as a victory for the Anglo-Portuguese army. They lost about 500 men, compared to roughly 600 for the French. Wellesley had succeeded in brushing aside de la Borde's force and clearing the way for the next leg of his march on Lisbon. However, de la Borde's primary objective had been to slow the British down. By forcing Wellesley to deploy his full force for a battle, then engaging him in a fighting retreat for the better part of a day, he had certainly succeeded in causing a delay. Still, it is remarkable that despite their strong positions and relatively small numbers, the French actually suffered more casualties than the British. This battle had not been easy for either side. Hot and muggy conditions, the French fighting on their back foot, outnumbered nearly 4-1, executing multiple fighting retreats, and the British launching repeated attacks uphill against tough positions, scrambling through ravines and heavy brush under enemy fire. Many of the troops on both sides were raw recruits, facing battle for the first time, but they had shown remarkable toughness and fighting spirit. That fighting spirit would be tested again just 4 days later. With the time Delaborde had bought him at Rolisa, Junot had been able to assemble a force that numbered somewhere between 9,000 and 13,000 men, and he was ready to fight. Wellesley would have a considerable advantage in numbers. Some estimates place the number of British and Portuguese troops as high as 20,000. However, the French had the advantage in artillery and cavalry. Despite the considerable difference in numbers, Junot would attack. The coming battle would be one last throw of the dice. Victory would buy Junot at least a few more months of breathing room. Maybe, with a little luck, he could pin the British down with their backs to the Atlantic and force them to surrender, then re-establish his lines of communication with French forces in Spain and just keep holding out until help arrived. If the British were victorious, well, Junot was already having a hard time maintaining the occupation with this small, isolated force. A major British victory would make that completely impossible. If he was defeated in the coming battle, Junot planned to abandon Portugal altogether, make a desperate retreat to the east, into Spain, where he might somehow link up with other French units and perhaps make it all the way back to the Pyrenees. It was a grim prospect, but Junot didn't feel he had any choice but to attack. The odds were against him, but if he waited, the British would only get stronger, and his own position would only get weaker. On August 15, 1808, the French forces in Lisbon attended parties in celebration of their emperor's birthday. The next day, they began the march north to face Wellesley in the decisive battle of the campaign. The French advantage in cavalry made it difficult for the British to learn much about their location or numbers, but the presence of this strong cavalry screen convinced some in the British leadership that an attack was imminent. Ironically, Wellesley was not among them. He believed the climactic battle would come further to the south, closer to Lisbon. However, as a good leader should, he listened to his subordinates and positioned his forces in a strong defensive line on good ground, in a series of hills and ridges near a town called Vimeru. Before his troops took up their final positions for the attack, Junot assembled them for a speech. Quote, "The enemy is in front of us. He wants to delay in order to be reinforced. Let us march towards him. The armies of the great Napoleon are not accustomed to waiting for the enemy. They are going to seek him out. It is Englishmen that you have to fight. It is not necessary to tell you more to excite your valor." End quote. The French spent much of the night preparing. At around dawn on August 21st, everything was ready for the battle that would decide the fate of Portugal. Wellesley was informed of the approaching enemy during the night, and told his officers, quote, "Now, gentlemen, go to your stations, but let there be no noise made, no sounding of bugles or beating of drums. Get your men quietly under arms, and desire all the outposts to be on alert." End quote. Ironically, Junot was planning on using almost the same plan Wellesley had used at Rolisa 4 days earlier. He would launch the main body of his force on the British center, then mount a secondary attack on the flank, hopefully pushing into the enemy rear. It was a solid strategy, we've seen it countless times, but it was usually employed by generals who had superior or at least roughly equivalent numbers to their enemy. Junot was outnumbered by perhaps as many as 2-1, and now he would be dividing that small force into two contingents and throwing it at tough positions. Junot was a gambler by nature, and this battle was certainly a big risk. The advancing French came into view from the British lines at around 8 in the morning. Wellesley moved some of his troops down from their high ground to engage the flank of the enemy as they advanced. The Battle of Vimeru had begun. In front of the French column was a relatively small group of British riflemen in skirmish formation. These were elite light infantry troops, armed with the state-of-the-art Baker rifle. The Baker rifle was slow to load and could be temperamental, but in the hands of a trained marksman, it was more than twice as accurate as a musket. The British riflemen excelled in these situations. They harassed the enemy column as long as they could, then fell back. Then the French came into range of the British artillery and were completely devastated. The attack slowed to a crawl, formations began to break apart. It seemed a rout was imminent, but somehow the French officers steadied their men, reformed their columns, and continued the attack. Seeing the enemy falter, the British riflemen ventured back out from their own lines to harass the French once again. Rifleman Benjamin Harris of the 95th would later recall, quote, "The French came down upon us in a column, and the riflemen immediately commenced a sharp fire upon them from whatever cover they could get a shelter behind, whilst our cannon played upon them from the rear. I saw regular lanes torn through their ranks as they advanced, which were immediately closed up again as they marched steadily on. Whenever we saw a round shot thus go through the mass, we raised a shout of delight." End quote. The riflemen were fighting very well, but light infantry in skirmish formation could not hold against the steady advance of an assault column. Once again, the rifles did all they could before retreating. Seeing his columns struggling, Junot sent in reinforcements. He didn't have much of a reserve to commit, but he couldn't risk his main attack failing so early in the fighting. Despite suffering horrific casualties, the French just kept moving forward. They were mostly fresh conscripts, but they were fighting like seasoned veterans. Soon, they were on the verge of overrunning some of the British artillery. The British 50th Regiment of Foot moved to stop them. One of them described the action. Quote, "When the French, in a compact mass, arrived sufficiently up the hill, now bristled with bayonets, the black cuffs poured in a well-directed volley upon the dense array. Then, cheering loudly, and led by its gallant chief, the whole regiment rushed forward to the charge, penetrated the formidable columns, and carried all before it." End quote. British regiments were identifiable by the different colors of their uniform facings, visible at the cuffs and collars. The 50th wore black facings, hence referring to them as the Black Cuffs. In response to this counterattack, Junot deployed more reserves, this time leading them forward personally. A Swiss officer in French service described the action, quote, "The charge was sounded, but the music lost itself in shouts of 'Long live the Emperor!' We came closer and closer to the truly formidable position of the English. The cannonballs took away whole ranks and burst in the following pelotons. Junot remained at the head in his fancy uniform of a senior general. Our artillery followed us on the flanks. We were about 50 yards from the English lines, still in a closed column, when the column stopped to deploy. A rolling volley like a drum roll received us, as I have never heard it. The first platoons of our column fell, the gunners of our artillery fell, and the horses were killed. The column was thrown back." End quote. The British counterattacked again and were able to capture some of the French artillery. Wellesley ordered his small contingent of cavalry to charge the retreating enemy. The British light dragoons galloped forward into the masses of retreating infantry and began cutting them down with sabers. However, the British horsemen became scattered as they advanced. They should have stopped, reformed, and charged again, but the troopers were too carried away. Instead, they fanned out in small, isolated groups. Junot ordered his own cavalry forward, and they quickly sent the light dragoons packing, killing many. The French cavalry had salvaged some of the army's honor, but the infantry in this sector were too battered to mount another attack. The fighting in this part of the battlefield died down. At this point, the battle probably should have been over. But remember, Junot had planned two attacks, one in the center and one on the flank. That flanking attack still had yet to be launched. With the main attack already thwarted, this maneuver stood almost no chance of success. It still could have been cancelled, and probably should have been, but Junot decided to let it go ahead. The flanking attack on the British right started with a cannonade. However, the main body of the British force was deployed behind the crest of a ridge, not visible to the French gunners, and difficult to hit. The French artillery did little damage. When the secondary assault finally began to advance, they were able to brush aside the British light infantry holding the crest of the hill, but once they were faced with the main body of the enemy, it immediately became clear that there were too few of them to break through. The British counterattacked and drove the French back, capturing several of their cannons. The standard-bearer of the French 12th Light Regiment fell wounded, and the Redcoats surged forward towards the regimental eagle, given to the 12th by the Emperor himself. It seemed the standard was surely lost, but at the last second it was saved by one of the regiment's captains. He got a musket ball to the neck for his trouble, but amazingly survived and continued carrying the eagle back to safety. To their credit, several of these French units were able to rally and turn around to offer resistance to the British, but there were far too few of them to make a stand for any significant length of time against the relentless onslaught of so many redcoats. General Wellesley actually had to ride out to this part of the battlefield personally to restrain his troops. He was worried they would advance too far and isolate themselves from the rest of the army. Remember, the British did not know how many French troops they were facing. Once their general had convinced them to stop, many of the British troops set down their muskets and pulled out their canteens. The day was hot, and it seemed the fighting was over. Amazingly, they were wrong. The French were still not beaten. Once again, the sound of trumpets and drums could be heard from the French lines. Junot's men called out, "Long live the Emperor," and launched themselves at the enemy once again. This was almost suicidal bravery. The battle was clearly lost, and there was not much to gain from launching another assault. They actually succeeded in pushing the surprised redcoats back slightly, but once the British got their bearings, they had little trouble stopping this attack, and once again, the French were brushed away by a strong counterattack. By this point, every French infantry unit on the battlefield had attacked the British lines and failed, many more than once. Both of the senior generals on Junot's left had been seriously wounded. One was in British custody. Perhaps as much as 20% of the French force had been killed or wounded. More had become separated from their units or been captured by the British. Finally, no one could deny the battle was well and truly over. At this point, Junot got in a carriage with his mistress and left the battlefield. As I've mentioned in past episodes, Junot was infamous for erratic behavior. It was left to his headquarters staff to organize the retreat. Junot's final throw of the dice had come up snake eyes. The Battle of Wimereux had been a complete disaster. The French troops had actually performed remarkably well, given the circumstances, but their commander's battle plan had not given them much of a chance of success. Then again, with his back to the wall and his enemy growing stronger by the day, Junot did not have many good options. Perhaps a desperate attack at the first opportunity actually was the right move under the circumstances. Whatever the case, the result was over 2,000 French soldiers killed or wounded. Junot was already hard-pressed for manpower. These were far more casualties than he could afford. He had also lost most of his artillery. The British and Portuguese only suffered about 700 casualties. Those numbers tell the story. French forces in Portugal had been broken. Wellesley's victory at Wimereux would be his last significant victory as commander-in-chief of British forces in Portugal. Not long after the battle, those more senior generals arrived in the country, and Wellesley was relegated to a supporting role. On August 30th, 9 days after Wimereux, the new British commander, Sir Hugh Dalrymple, signed an agreement with Junot, the Convention of Sintra. The French agreed to cease all further resistance in Portugal, and in exchange, the British would provide the remnants of Junot's command safe passage back to France. The struggle for Portugal was over, at least for the moment. although, as we'll see in the future, this story has a somewhat strange postscript. That gets us more or less caught up with events in Portugal. However, before we return to Napoleon and the Grande Armée, we need to cover an important engagement in Spain that I've alluded to in past episodes, the Siege of Zaragoza. Zaragoza was the largest and most important city in the province of Aragon. It's actually not far from the French border, only about 200 kilometers, or 125 miles. The leading figures among the Aragonese patriots were two brothers from a senior noble family, José and Luis de Palafox y Melzi. The Aragonese patriots had started the rebellion at a huge disadvantage. There were a lot of French soldiers stationed in the area, and only about 500 Spanish regulars from the old Royal Army. The Palafox brothers had managed to pull together an improvised army of several thousand, almost exclusively young volunteers with no training or experience. As was the case basically everywhere in Spain, the local juntas struggled to scrape together even basic equipment and weapons. No surprise, this force did not fare very well in their first encounters with the French. After a few unsuccessful engagements, they fell back to a strong defensive position, the city of Zaragoza. This had been a major urban center for centuries. It was tightly packed with high stone buildings, only navigable by narrow, winding medieval streets. Extremely favorable conditions for the defenders. And Zaragoza still had an old-fashioned city wall around its entire perimeter. The walls looked quite imposing, but they were really more of a customs barrier than military fortifications, so this was not quite as big an advantage as it might have seemed. Still, Zaragoza was a highly defensible location. The Patriot commander, General José de Palafox, turned out to be a competent and inspiring leader. After he led his small volunteer army into the city, many Zaragozans joined up, and many others assisted in building fortifications, preparing supplies, and organizing the city for resistance. The Patriot garrison swelled to over 10,000 troops, although they were almost totally inexperienced, untrained, and critically short on weapons. When the French came, they would have to depend on their strong position to equalize things. French forces arrived outside the walls on June 15, 1808. This was still very early in the rebellion, only a day after the Second Battle of El Bruc, which we discussed in episode 113. You might recall that the defeated French forces in that engagement were actually on their way to Zaragoza to help take the city. Despite the enthusiasm of the local people, the Patriot leadership seemed convinced the city would fall. General Palafox and the provincial junta of Aragon evacuated the city. The garrison became effectively leaderless. The defense of Zaragoza would be largely self-organized by the people of the city and the Patriot volunteers. They elected their own military leaders, much to the consternation of the established authorities, who thought this was all a little too reminiscent of a revolution. The French commander, General Charles Lefebvre de Nouet, decided to try to take Zaragoza by storm. He only had about 4,000 men. French reinforcements had been blocked by other Patriot forces. The defenders of Zaragoza actually outnumbered the attackers by nearly 3-1. Attempting to storm the city with this small force would be a big risk. But Lefebvre believed he had to take it. Zaragoza was a very strong position. The longer he waited, the better prepared the defenders would be. And besides, in previous engagements, the Aragonese patriots had not been able to stand against sustained pressure from French regulars. Lefebvre hoped that same pattern would hold true. On June 16th, the French threw themselves at Zaragoza. They attacked in three columns, each aimed at one of the city's gates. Despite ferocious Spanish resistance, the French succeeded in penetrating the walls. A group of Polish lancers charged into the city. It seemed General Lefebvre's gamble had paid off. But once the Poles entered Zaragoza, they found they had nowhere to go. The Patriots had prepared their defenses well. Rather than relying only on those old walls to hold off the French, they had built several layers of improvised defensive positions inside the city. Every street was blocked with barricades. Patriot militiamen poured lead into the charging Poles from prepared firing positions inside nearby buildings. Ordinary civilians worked up the courage to attack the Poles with knives, clubs, and even rocks. Men, women, and even children joined the melee. The Lancers were unable to exploit their breakthrough, and their comrades were too afraid to follow. The surviving horsemen had no option but to gallop back out the way they came. Saragossa would hold, at least for now. General Lefebvre had no choice but to prepare for a real protracted siege. Around 700 French troops had been killed or wounded in the assault, nearly 20% of Lefebvre's entire force. Spanish casualties are unknown, but presumably higher. Inside the city, the defenders celebrated. One resident described watching the women of Saragossa, quote, running in groups through the streets, displaying the eagles, the shakos, the backpacks, the fine shirts and epaulettes taken from the French, so that all could see that the enemy soldiers, and even their officers, had been conquered by Saragossan arms. End quote. Shortly after the failed assault, Lefebvre got even worse news. General Palafox had managed to pull together another improvised Patriot army of around 4,000 men, and it was on its way towards Saragossa, aiming to lift the siege. The French were already badly outnumbered. If those two armies were able to unite, the Patriots might easily turn the tables and crush the smaller French force. Once again, Lefebvre decided to take a risk. He gathered most of his troops to attack this column, leaving only a token force behind at Saragossa to maintain the siege lines. This time, the gamble paid off. That advancing Patriot column was completely shattered, and the French were able to get back to the siege lines before the garrison could inflict any serious damage. The Patriot volunteers had plenty of fighting spirit, but their deficiencies showed when they had to face the French in open battle. After the chaotic opening weeks of the war, the situation stabilized slightly, and French reinforcements began to trickle in. By late June, the attacking and defending forces were roughly equal in size. The French also brought in heavy artillery, and General Lefebvre was replaced by a more senior commander, General Jean-Antoine Verdier. Despite these reinforcements, the French perimeter around Saragossa was just too big. The Patriots were able to continue bringing food, supplies, and ammunition into the city. General Palafox realized he had made a mistake in leaving the defense so quickly, and found his way through the French lines to retake command. After failing to storm Saragossa, the French adopted a more methodical approach, capturing strategic outlying areas so they could build batteries for their heavy guns, and bombard the defenders at will. The walls of Saragossa had been designed mostly to keep smugglers from entering the city without passing through the customs inspection at the gates, not to resist modern heavy artillery. Within a few weeks, the French had blasted several huge breaches into the walls. The Patriots attempted counter-battery fire, but their inexperienced gun crews were torn apart by the French. Many of the Spanish cannon were destroyed, and the rest had to be withdrawn to safer positions. On July 2nd, the French attacked again. Verdier decided to hit the defenders at as many points as possible, forcing them to spread out. The French made progress, but once again, resistance was fierce. Near one of the breaches, a 22-year-old woman named Agustina de Aragon was assisting a gun crew, led by her boyfriend. A French attack column surged forward, and the Patriot gunners loaded the cannon with grapeshot for close-range fire. Unfortunately for them, the French fired first. Just before they could touch the match to the cannon, every man in the gun crew went down dead or wounded in a hail of bullets. Out of all the nearby defenders, only Agustina de Aragon had the bravery and presence of mind to rush forward, grab the match, and fire the cannon. By this point, the French were only a few feet away. The grape shot tore them apart, and the attack was stopped. Once again, the French were repulsed, and once again, casualties were heavy on both sides. Inside Saragossa, Agustina de Aragon was hailed as the hero of the day. In recognition of her bravery and cool-headedness, General Palafox offered her a battlefield commission at the rank of lieutenant, which she accepted. A surprising number of women served in the militaries of the Napoleonic Wars, but almost all did so in secret, after adopting a male identity. Lieutenant Aragon was one of the very few who did so openly, and as far as I know, the only one who actually participated in combat. Probably unsurprisingly, she has gone down in history as a Spanish folk hero. Lord Byron, perhaps the most famous poet of the 19th century, dedicated a long passage to Agustina de Aragon in his poem Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. Quote, "Ye who shall marvel when you hear her tale, oh, had you known her in her softer hour, marked her black eye that mocks her coal-black veil, heard her light lively tones in lady's bower, seen her long locks that foil the painter's power, her fairy form with more than female grace, scarce would you deem that Saragossa's tower beheld her smile in danger's gorgon face, thin the closed ranks, and lead in glory's fearful chase. Her lover sinks, she sheds no ill-timed tear. Her chief is slain, she fills his fatal post. Her fellows flee, she checks their base career. The foe retires, she leads the sallying host. Who can appease like her a lover's ghost? Who can avenge so well a leader's fall? What maid retrieve when man's flushed hope is lost? Who hangs so fiercely on the flying Gaul, foiled by a woman's hand before a battered wall?" End quote. As Byron wrote, the French had been foiled again, but General Verdier was not beaten. He shifted strategies again. Now the French would focus on the as-yet-untouched western approaches to the city. They captured some outlying suburbs in this area and set up new batteries, then proceeded to blast several more breaches into the walls. By now, the city had been under siege for nearly 2 months. The Patriots hadn't had the time or the organization to prepare for protracted resistance. They were running low on all kinds of supplies. Weeks of heavy bombardment and successive French attacks had taken a toll. However, fighting spirit remained high. By early August, the French were ready to attack again. Just to keep the timeline straight, this was about 2 weeks after the French disaster at Bailen, although the news had not yet reached Saragossa. On August 4, 1808, the French stormed the breaches yet again. Finally, for the first time since the siege began, not only were they able to secure the breaches themselves, but they actually managed to push into the city, overcoming several of the Patriot barricades. The Spanish fought tenaciously, but were forced to give up ground. As more and more French troops poured into those breaches, General Verdier believed the Patriots were finally finished. He sent an officer towards the Spanish lines under a flag of truce to deliver a note to General Palafox. Verdier got right to the point. His letter read simply, quote, "Surrender," end quote. Palafox's response was almost as brief, quote, "War to the knife," end quote. He intended to keep fighting to the last. And so the French kept up the advance. This was real brutal fighting, often at close quarters, street to street, and even house to house. Every step the French took into the city was paid for in blood. As the sun set on August 4th, about half of Saragossa was under French control. The defense of the city had been heroic, but it looked like it was about to enter a tragic, bloody final act. But the Patriots continued to show surprising courage and toughness. As the French finally began to run out of steam, the Spanish counterattacked and took back much of the ground they had lost. By now, the situation within Saragossa was complete chaos. There were no front lines anymore. In French-controlled areas, there were numerous pockets of Spaniards who had been overrun by the initial assault, but kept fighting. And behind the Spanish lines, there were similar pockets of French troops, who had become isolated in the counterattack, but continued holding out. The combatants fought whoever was nearby, and carried on with knives and bayonets when they ran out of ammunition. The slaughter only ended when it became too dark to fight. Both sides passed an uneasy and probably sleepless night in their respective sections of the city, and after sunrise, the fighting began again, much as it had the day before. You would think 2 days of brutal urban warfare would have pushed these people beyond the limits of their endurance, but the battle just continued. On August 6th, a small group of Patriot soldiers somehow managed to fight their way into the city with a convoy of supplies and ammunition, a much-needed lifeline for the defenders. The fighting only began to slow down when rumors of the French disaster at Bailen began to filter into the city. Palafox and Verdier both immediately understood the significance of this news. It didn't matter how close the French in Saragossa were to victory, they would soon be ordered to evacuate. Sporadic combat continued, but the outcome was no longer in doubt. Even in defeat, Verdier was merciless. He kept up the bombardment. The French would not be able to take all their gunpowder and ammunition with them. Better to shoot it at the Spanish than destroy it and see it wasted. He also demolished as much of the city's defenses as possible, including many civilian buildings. To the French, this was just simple pragmatism. They hoped to be back to attack the city again sometime soon, and they wanted to make the task a little easier the next time. But to the Spanish, it felt like wanton cruelty, born out of spite. By August 17th, the French were finally gone. Against all odds, the ragtag Patriot garrison and the average people of Saragossa had successfully defended their city. Casualty numbers are very hard to estimate given the nature of the fighting, but they were severe. The French lost around 3,500 men, nearly 1 in 4 of the besiegers. Spanish casualties may have been over 5,000. But in this brutal, confused fighting, these are not much more than guesses. Once again, the Patriots were emboldened. This had not been an overwhelming triumph, like the victory at Bailen. In fact, if the situation had been only slightly different and Verdier had been able to continue his attack, there's a good chance Saragossa would have eventually fallen. Although this would have been a hollow victory after paying such a steep cost in blood. Still, the courage and the toughness of the defenders was a shining example to the whole country. Unlike at Bailen, the vast majority of the Spanish combatants were not professional soldiers. In fact, many were not much more than armed townspeople. And yet, they had delivered the greatest army in the world another bloody nose. France had suffered stunning reversals in Iberia in the summer of 1808. France's most powerful enemy, Great Britain, had finally secured a large, durable base of operations on the European continent, after multiple failed attempts over the course of years. And perhaps worst of all, the aura of invincibility around Napoleon's armies had been severely tarnished. Only a few months ago, many educated observers believed France was on the verge of a total victory. It hadn't taken very long for that to change. Now, nothing seemed certain, other than more bloodshed and more destruction. Bonaparte himself considered these nothing more than temporary setbacks. Soon, the emperor would enter Spain, at the head of the Grande Armée, and he aimed to prove all the naysayers wrong. Before we go, I'd like to give a shout-out to a book that was a huge help in writing the Portuguese chapter of this episode, So Just and Glorious a Cause, by Rob Griffith. I would highly recommend this book. There are a lot of ins and outs to the Portuguese campaign that we just didn't have time to cover in this episode. I could easily have made that section 4 hours long, and I still wouldn't have had time to cover all the fascinating details Rob explores in this book. I will probably be including some of that material in the next bonus episode, so sign up on Patreon if you want to hear more about Wellesley and Junot in Portugal. Anyway, that's all for now. As always, thanks for listening.